This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Good afternoon and welcome. Welcome to all of you, whether you be from NATO or indeed for those who have made the effort to come from outside and brave the weather to come here. Can I just check that the system is working? Because there is nothing worse than me starting to witter away and you realise that you can't understand a word I'm saying.
You know we're going to run out of civilization's lifeblood, fossil fuels. And if we burn what's left, the climate may tip into a mass extinction event. Meanwhile, barking madness seems to be the only growth industry in some places. Is it time for more pills, booze, or end-time religion? Our next guest says there may be some hope left. Sean Chamberlain's blog is called Dark Optimism, and that may be as good as it gets. Sean is part of the transition movement in Britain. He's the author of the new book, The Transition Timeline for a Local Resilient Future, and part of an upcoming report for the British Parliament on a scheme to give everyone an energy quota. Sean, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thanks for having me, Alex.
Okay, well, let's start with what is dark optimism?
Well, it all started actually talking with a friend of mine who was attempting to figure out what kind of a person I am, what kind of a thinker I am, and I was lying in bed that night thinking about it, and that sort of just came to me in a flash that I'm a dark optimist, and over time it became the title for the work that I do. But really it's looking at life and not being afraid to look at it when it's dark, when it's scary, which, as you well know, when we look into the future, it certainly can be at the moment. But with a faith that if we explore the unknown, we often find that when things are unknown, they're more scary than when we actually look at them. In all the horror movies, you'll find the scariest monsters, the ones you never see and you imagine. So that actually looking into the darkness is a tool that brings us realism that we can then use to create a better future than the one that we're left with by running away from that darkness.
Yes, and you've been looking less for a technical fix and more to some of the stories we tell ourselves. How can that help us out?
Yeah, well, I mean, this ties in a lot with my book. I mean, when I was doing the research for that, it was a project that came out of the transition movement, and various of the transition communities were trying to write their energy descent action plans, so looking 20 years into the future of their own communities. And they found that was very difficult because they needed to know about some of the big scale issues that were really going to affect their communities, but which maybe they couldn't directly affect. So things like climate change and peak oil, but also government policy decisions, national food supply, things like this. And as I looked at the shape of our future, I realized that it's really shaped by the cultural stories that we tell ourselves, the narratives that flow throughout our culture. And really, I found, in my opinion, that there are three dominant stories that really shape our ideas. And one is the idea that the future will basically look like today, that we'll just carry on much the same. And you see that a lot in government documents, for example, that assume this has happened up till now, and so we assume that that trend will carry on into the future. And a second story that's very powerful is the sort of apocalypse story, whatever that looks like, whether that's religious apocalypse or whether it's Terminator or whether it's the Age of Stupid, whatever form that takes, that's a narrative that we see throughout our culture. And the third one, I think, is, as you've just hinted, the sort of the techno-utopia idea that science and progress will save us all and that we'll move on into this, I don't know, maybe Star Trek kind of a future. And those three stories I found when I was talking to a huge diversity of people about our futures, I could usually categorize them quite easily into one or more than one sometimes a sort of compound vision based on a couple of those. And so one of the things that we're trying to do in the transition movement is create a fourth story of our future, a story that's based around realistically looking at the limits, the environmental limits that we're starting to really bump up against, and creating a better future within that realist context.
Seems to me at times that the denial movement or just letting things keep on going the way it is may be the way it turns out. Did you work out in your book what that world would look like in 2020 or 2030?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I really learned in writing the book about resilience, which is one of the core concepts in transition, is that it's very important not to just create a single vision of the future, but rather to explore adequately a set of different visions. And so what we did in the writing of the book was explore four of those scenarios based on each of the four stories I've just talked about, and look at a timeline for each of those out to 2030. Because I like to say resilience is humility in action, really. We have to accept that, as the Chinese say, when men speak of the future, the gods laugh. We have to accept that we don't know what's coming, and that the most sensible things that we can do are things which are useful in a range of possible futures. So absolutely, that's something we explored, is looking at how each of those sort of cultural stories would pan out, taken to its logical conclusion, but then looking in a lot more depth at the transition vision, for the simple reason that that doesn't have a lot of traction in our society at the moment. I think it really needs fleshing out so that people can feel that it's a real vision that can sort of get them out of bed in the morning.
I find it interesting that while you're advocating and talking about joining a community movement at the local level to get away from fossil dependence, you're also helping with a national action plan by the UK government. Can you give us a peek into the upcoming report on tradable energy quotas and maybe start by explaining what those are?
Well, tradable energy quotas is a concept that's gone by a lot of names, things like carbon rationing and energy rationing, very much among them. I think at the moment, within certainly green circles, there's a lot of backlash against this idea of tradable, in that carbon trading is something that, with good reason, is deeply mistrusted. But when it comes to looking at the practical detail of how an energy or carbon rationing scheme would operate, tradability becomes very essential to the concept, because unlike something like food, which certainly here in the UK we have living memory experience of food rationing, but food is something that people need basically the same amount of each, roughly speaking. Energy is not quite like that, in that, you know, certain professions, a country doctor, say, or perhaps a farmer, require more energy than other lifestyles. And so if we just gave everyone an equal entitlement of energy, then we'd end up with all the above average energy use professions in the country ceasing to exist overnight, which would obviously not be a great advantage to the society. So the idea of tradable energy quotas is essentially that once you've got your constraint, whether that's a national carbon budget or whether that's a national oil depletion or gas depletion problem, perhaps, that gives you a declining budget which you can then lay out over, say, a 20-year period. And then that budget is turned into essentially rations for the economy. And those are given out on an equal per capita basis to every individual in the country. And the proportion that's relevant to emissions from industry and organizations is auctioned to those organizations. And this means that all the energy and carbon within the economy can be captured and accounted for, and the carbon budget can actually be achieved, which is something which is really lacking in our international negotiations at the moment, all sorts of promises, but very little idea of how to achieve them. So those can actually be achieved without the need to, you know, measure tailgate emissions on cars or specific emissions from a particular factory, because it's done at the national scale. And as you say, it sort of does seem like there's a contradiction between addressing things at that level and the community scale. And I think my personal journey really was that maybe 5 years ago or so, when I was wondering what I could do about this global situation, my first thought was, well, I need to get involved with the Conference of Parties process, the UN, Copenhagen, Kyoto type process, because that seemed to me, you know, that's where the big action's at. That's where I can really make a difference. And there was a quote from my now colleague, David Fleming, that really changed my whole perspective on that. He said, large-scale problems do not require large-scale solutions. They require small-scale solutions within a large-scale framework. And the more I think about that, the more I see the truth in it. And so really what I've been doing since then in my life is working at the small scale, working on those small-scale solutions, trying to support the wonderful diversity of solutions, not just transition towns, but the huge diversity of local solutions that are out there, but also recognizing that we really do need those frameworks to sort of harness all those individual efforts and ensure that they are sufficient to the scale of the challenges that we face. Otherwise, you know, obviously something like climate change is a problem which, if one group does their bit and another group doesn't, then we don't have a solution. So we do need these frameworks. But I really feel that without a focus on the local and the individual levels, the frameworks are empty. The real realization for me was when I thought, what is the point of something like Copenhagen? I mean, if Copenhagen had produced the treaty that we all dreamed of, really, that would have meant nothing if it didn't stimulate change at the local level. I mean, that's where all the emissions come from. That's where all the energy demand comes from. So all of the international and national level stuff only exists as a way to stimulate and support changes at the community level. And once that sort of clicked in my head, it became very obvious that the community level would become the focus of my efforts while still trying to contribute to getting some kind of reasonable framework at that level.
Well, I can see how these tradable energy quotas would give the individual more of a chance to figure out their own solutions. But I think we all have the worry, and does this address it, that somehow the fat cats are going to keep flying around and driving in limousines and wasting energy in huge houses, while the poorest among us will have trouble getting enough energy for heating their homes if peak oil comes about and if there's a shortage of supplies. How do we get around that?
Sure, sure. I mean, that's obviously the fear with a tradable ration rather than an absolute ration. I think the key thing to remember is that in such a scheme, it's absolutely true that the rich would be able to buy surplus rations from the poor if the poor found that they had surplus rations. And really, that is just a consequence of the fact that we live in a capitalist system. I mean, this is not a suggestion that overthrows capitalism, and it is a fundamental fact of capitalism that if you're richer, you can consume more of stuff. But really, the critical thing about this scheme is that it changes the current picture, whereas currently, if oil, for example, is in short supply, then it goes to either the person who can bid the most or the person who moves the quickest and gets to the gas station first. Under this scheme, if the rich did consume more, they would be paying the poor directly for the privilege. So it would actually be redistributing the wealth from the high consumers to the low. So not only would it create a very strong incentive on people of all income levels to reduce their income, it would also ensure that people were compensated directly if there was an imbalance in energy use throughout the economy.
Recently in the United States, there have been threats of revolution and rage over a very basic plan for health care coverage. Mm. Imagine the furor if gas-happy citizens are being told big government is going to ration your energy supplies. That's going to be a real problem. And yet, you know, when I look at Saudi Arabia and Kuwait building up their own energy and using their own oil supplies, and I look at what's happening in China, all the car sales and everything, it looks like rationing is almost inevitable sooner or later.
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is the fundamental problem that environmental thinkers have had for a very long time, is that really what we're doing here is we're recognizing pre-existing natural limits and we're trying to address them in a rational way. And again, this comes back to the issue of cultural stories. If our cultural story tells us that there's infinite abundance and that human ingenuity will continue to create energy sources out of nothing forevermore, then if anyone comes along and tells you that they want to ration it, well, obviously they're an enemy and must be opposed. On the other hand, if our story tells us, well, you know, we're moving into a period where we're really approaching our environmental limits and we need to address that in the most sensible, painless, rational way possible, then suddenly sharing out what's available in the fairest possible way becomes a no-brainer. So really, this is why a lot of my work focuses on shifting these cultural perspectives, because as you say, the political battles that are needed to implement something like a national rationing scheme will never be won while the current cultural stories that shape that discourse are still in place.
Your report for Lean Energy Connection gives two reasons for tackling carbon. We're bound to run out of supplies and it's wrecking the atmosphere. But I've just read in the Guardian newspaper March 22nd about a government advisory board giving us really a third reason, one I've been harping about. The pollution from burning carbon, mostly from vehicles, is killing city dwellers by the thousands. The Committee of MPs estimate up to 50,000 people die prematurely in Britain alone every year due to smog. Will you add that list of motivations to clean up the system?
Well, absolutely. I think that is a critical thing. It's very interesting, actually, at the moment that our UK government is seemingly having a bit of a change of heart on its attitude to fossil fuels, I suppose you might say. I mean, there's that report that you've just mentioned. There's also just yesterday they've announced that off the back of... we've had a report here by a group called the Peak Oil Task Force, which is an industry group made up of some of our biggest companies, including Virgin, whose chairman Richard Branson is very well known here. I don't know how well his fame spread across the Atlantic. And some of our big transportation groups, our rail companies, launched a report basically stating that as industry, they're deeply, deeply worried that government aren't taking peak oil seriously enough and that they really need some support on this from the government level. And the government yesterday have put out a statement saying essentially that they're a bit confused, because on the one hand they've got the likes of Shell telling them there's nothing to worry about, on the other hand they've got some of their biggest industry representatives saying they're terribly worried about it. And so they've now called together a colloquium, I think they've called it, pulling together some of the various stakeholders on this issue to try and get to the bottom of why there's so much disagreement. And we've got a couple of representatives of the UK transition movement going along to that meeting it is interesting that whereas a few years ago you were sort of laughed out of the room for talking about the need to get off fossil fuels, these days it seems to be almost, I don't know, zeitgeisty.
Yes, well, this is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Sean Chamberlain, a British author and thinker, deeply involved with the transition movement. And I want to ask you now, how can we use this transition movement to turn what looks like despair into better lives around us?
Wow, that's a big question. I suppose despair has a certain, in a strange way, has a certain motivation within it, in that despair is looking at what we expect the future to look like and realizing that it isn't what we want. And I think we can channel that part of despair. And if we can make people understand that a different future is possible, then suddenly that despair becomes not a sort of motivator to inaction, but a huge motivator to action. And I suppose really that's the dark optimism idea in practice. So again, it's about this transition vision of what our future could look like and trying to make that a visible reality that people can see and see that they can get involved with. And I think part of the sort of beauty of transition is that it operates on a human scale, really. You're getting together with a group of maybe 15 other people from your local community to work on a particular practical project. And there's something in us that just functions on that scale. It's, you know, the people who are thinking about the kind of topics that maybe are often talked about on Radio EcoShock, we're used to thinking about, God, how can we, I don't know, feed 7 billion people or whatever it is. But it's a very hard job to get a human brain to think on that kind of a scale. Whereas operating at the human scale, it sort of soothes that despair by saying, well, here I am, I'm doing something practical, I'm doing something real, I'm doing it with my community. And while there's part of your brain that's saying, oh, but is it enough? Is it sufficient? That's kind of soothed by the knowledge that there's this movement of thousands of communities around the world that are doing the same things. And given the abject failure of the sort of international political process to deal with the scale of problems we're looking at, I think that's where the relief from despair can come from.
Yes, there's some healing from learning to grow food or learning a skill or meeting with others to get something done. I was wondering, can you give us some specifics from the transition community that you've been working with?
Yeah, I'm based in Kingston upon Thames, which is sort of suburb of southwest London. And some of the things we've been doing, we've had quite an engagement with our local allotment groups, and we've been working to try and expand the space that's available for food growing locally, both through getting more land allocated for that, but also to things like our local council here, trying to get flower beds and things turned into edible flower beds, which are still as attractive, but also creating more usefulness and creating more local resilience through that. And so that would be one example where our local groups have been working to do something which feels engaging, which feels pleasurable, which feels like it's tangible and it's building something. It also creates a sort of demonstration for the rest of the community of what transition is about, and of course builds that food resilience so that if we do come to a situation where we're really struggling to get by, then we're creating more resilience for that. I think for me personally, one of the things that I find most important about transition is that it's a process which makes sense whether or not we win the fight on climate change, if you like. You know, whether we're fighting to try and avoid the tipping points into unstoppable runaway climate change, transition has a very important role in trying to win that fight. But equally, if we lose that fight, transition is going to have a very important role to play in creating that resilience against the kind of situations we're likely to find ourselves in. And I think for a lot of people who are deeply troubled by the fact that we could be losing that fight, that's one of the most powerful aspects of it.
Well, you've just answered one of the questions I had, which was that I've heard you say climate change may be unstoppable as early as 2016. That only gives us 5 years, and so a critic might say, well, the transition movement, that's going to be too slow to make significant changes by then, and ditto the slow drop by tradable emissions quotas. It might take years just to get public acceptance. So are you finding that you can overcome those fears and still get people going on these projects?
Yeah, as I say, I think the crucial thing is, if that's something which is a fear, and it certainly is a fear that I've spoken to lots of people that they find quite paralyzing, I think the key thing is to work on projects which, as I say, make sense either way. And tradable energy quotas, yes, absolutely has a role in allowing nations to be able to meet the incredibly stringent carbon targets that are going to be necessary if we're going to avoid unstoppable runaway. But equally, even if we cross those tipping points, we're still going to have an energy problem. we're still going to have this situation to deal with, and having those systems in place is going to make the response to that an awful lot more rational and sane. I think this sort of two-pronged approach is the thing that helps people to remain sane in times which, as you say, can be quite despair-filled for a lot of people who are trying to engage with these issues.
There must be people in these communities who are very apathetic or even outright hostile to changes in their lifestyle. How do we handle that?
Listening, I think, is the straightforward answer. I mean, here in Kingston, it's a fairly affluent suburb on the whole, but equally we have what we call council estates here, which are some of the most deprived areas of London. And trying to find common ground between the very different perspectives on life here has been one of our real challenges. And I think listening to each other and not feeling like, you know, oh, I've listened to Radio EcoShock and I've heard this answer and I'm going to go out and apply it, but actually respecting the opinions of the different people and the stories that the different people bring, and recognizing that a diversity of outlooks, diversity of stories is a real strength, not a weakness. We don't need to agree on every aspect of what the future is going to look like. What we need to do is have a diversity of stories from which we can choose and apply the most appropriate if we're going to create the most positive future that we can.
I sometimes see all these things, transition, community building, and local food production, as sort of a lifeboat building process. But then again, is there anything wrong with lifeboats if we think the ship might be sinking? Is that dark optimism?
I think dark optimism would say there's nothing wrong with lifeboats, whether you think the ship's sinking or it's going to stay floating. Either way, they're good things, so there's no harm in building them.
Okay. Well, we're starting to run out of time. Is there something else you'd like to tell our listeners at this point?
Ah, that's always a difficult question. I think the key thing is really to follow your passions. I mean, regardless of where it is, I mean, if you feel like, this climate change thing really just leaves me cold, and I can see that it's incredibly important, and I can see that it's this huge world-changing thing that's coming, but really what I want to be doing is, making documentaries or you know, whatever that person's passion is, creating great art. I think it's very important that we do follow our passions. There's a quote that's really always inspired me, which is, don't ask what the world needs, ask what makes you come alive, and go do that. Because what the world needs is people who've come alive. And I think there's a guy here called David Attenborough, who's a wildlife documentary maker for the BBC. And he has been doing that for his whole life, and he's getting on a bit now. And he's generally regarded in all the polls on such things as the most trusted figure in Britain, because we all sort of learned about nature and the things by watching his programs. And when he came out in one of his programs and said something like, the only question remaining on climate change now is whether it's a disaster or an outright catastrophe. That was one of the key moments in our country for shifting the whole debate, the whole perspective, because everyone is so used to his word being law on the things that he talks about. And I found that so interesting, because I thought if he'd given up on his passion to be a wildlife documentary maker and gone and spent his life campaigning on climate change, he might never have made as much impact on that very different issue as he did by doing the thing that made him come alive. So I think that would be my one thing for people to take home, is don't give up on what you're passionate about. It'll be useful.
That is a beautiful vision. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Our guest has been Sean Chamberlain. He's working on a report to the British Parliament on energy rationing. His latest book is The Transition Timeline for a Local Resilient Future. And you can get that book and a lot more of his stimulating views at his blog, darkoptimism.org. Sean, thank you so much for sharing all this with us.
Thanks, it's been a pleasure.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.